Sabrina.
And on this podcast, we look at history through the eyes of sisterhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. And guess what?
What?
This is our first time recording in the same space.
I didn't need to guess that because I'm in the same space.
I asked you to guess and you still didn't get it, so.
So, yeah, good point. But, yeah, Sistery Untold first. I was going to try to make a pun about Sistery Untold. Like, never mind. Like, never before seen Sistery. Like, we're making Sistery by recording in person.
This is embarrassing.
I know. Sorry. That's why I didn't want to try. Today is part two of last week's episode, which is about Tsuda Ume and Yamagawa Sudamatsu, who were two girls from Japan in the 1870s who moved to America. And Tsuda Ume's father was a Japanese man who had lived in the West and was really fascinated in it and wanted his daughter to be educated. So he encouraged her to go on this trip. And Sudamatsu's family both families have been on the losing side of the war, but her family felt the brunt of it a lot more because they were found from a town that was super destroyed in the war, and their family was struggling a lot financially, and so her older brother had her go on this trip. And they moved to America, and where we left them off, they had just arrived in D.C. and were living together in a house with three other girls. So yeah, last time we talked about these five girls who went on a mission to the United States as part of the Iwakura mission. And they were all intending to stay for 10 years to get an education before they moved back to Japan. And what we didn't talk about last time was that there was another really similar mission that started in the summer of 1872, so about 6 months after the girls arrived. And this was a group of 30 Chinese boys who were aged 10 to 16, and they were part of the Chinese Educational Mission. And they arrived in New England and had a similar goal of receiving an American education.
I feel like there's romance in the air.
There was kind of a little bit of flirting at one point, but that's not the point I'm trying to make. But the thing is that they were moving to New England, and that kind of brought New England to the attention of Arinori Mori, who was one of the leaders of the Iwakura mission, especially this section of the girls, they're part of the mission. And so public education was already really well established in New England. And so he was drawn to that and the fact that all of these other boys were there too. And then also Sudamatsu, we talked about last time, she had an older brother who lived in Connecticut and went to Yale. And he was really worried about her losing connection with her Japanese identity while she was in America, so he really wanted her to move there. And on the other hand, their trip leader was also worried that the girls weren't getting enough exposure to American culture because they were just living in their own little bubble in this house in Washington, D.C. area. So for all of these reasons, Arinori ended up consulting with some Americans in Connecticut, as well as Sudamatsu's brother, to find a home for Sudamatsu and Shige. Meanwhile, Ume would return to live with the Landmans, who were their original host family. And the two eldest girls, Ryo and Tei, were returning to Japan because of ill health. And I think I mentioned last time, she was going blind. This thing called snow blindness, which was just from looking at the snow, I guess, when they were driving across, when they were taking trains across the country. And then Tei returned because of quote unquote personal reasons.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. And Ume was super close to the other girls, so it's lucky that she got to at least go back to a family she was more familiar with instead of moving to a new state with new people and all of that. And Sudamatsu and Shige both went to live with Leonard Bacon, who was one of New Haven's intellectual elite. He was a 70-year-old pastor of First Church. He was and a professor of theology at Yale and a prolific writer and editor. He'd fathered 14 children.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah, between two wives, though, so at least I guess that's a little bit better.
Seven children with one wife is still a lot.
Yeah. And his youngest daughter was just 14, while his oldest daughter was 46. So it was a big range. And the oldest daughter, Rebecca, was the one who, the first one who looked into adopting the girls. And she wrote to her father that she went to talk to someone about, quote, the little Jap, meaning Sudamatsu, and said that she would write to her brother right away about trying to get her, because she said, in the meantime, someone may have snapped her up, but that is not likely. I told her that Mr. Van Nam and B.G. Northrop might say what they thought would be a fair price for her, and you would see. And so we've definitely seen like some hints of racism in the last episode, but I think this is like a super, super clear instance of objectification of these girls. Just trying to like basically buy them.
I like don't know what to say. I was trying to think of like what's something witty I can say, but I was just kind of too shocked.
Yeah, no, it's really messed up. And what's confusing is also like these girls, like the Japanese government is paying for them to live with them. So these families are actually kind of like making money because they're like taking them on as boarders. So it's like a weird transaction, so to speak. And so Leonard Bacon himself had some questionable politics. He supported the Back to Africa movement, which was this movement that some like Black Americans also supported, some prominent Black Americans. But basically he thought that Black and white people were inherently equal, but that was impossible for them not to be oppressed in America. So he thought that sending them back to Africa would allow them to enjoy freedom as well as spread the gospel to Africans. That was like a big part of the movement too. And he definitely hoped that his Japanese daughters would eventually bring Christianity with them when they returned to Japan in a decade. So that was his like ulterior motive, I guess. And Sudamatsu's brother was not super keen on this, and he permitted her to go to church with the family, but asked that Leonard would not give her any religious instruction. And Leonard, at least in his letters, seemed excited to meet the girls, partially, like I said, because his family would receive room and board for them. But he wrote, quote, "What we propose is to receive her not simply as a boarder and a lodger, but as if she were the child of some relative or near friend who would expect us to have a parental care over her and to treat her with all parental kindness. She will be in the family as if she were one of our grandchildren."
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I think that's very sweet. And then on the evening of October 30th, 1872, Shige and Sudamatsu boarded a train for New Haven, but they wouldn't stay together for long. Their new parents noticed right away that they were so bonded to each other that as long as they lived together, they wouldn't really learn English. So they sent Shige to live with another minister named John Abbott. And while Shige and Sudamatsu were thrown into unfamiliar environments, Ume was going back to familiar territory, and she was super excited to move back in with the Landmans. Charles Landman said that Ume was too young to go to boarding school, and that since his wife had taken such a strong liking to her back when she first lived with them, they wanted to welcome her back into their home for at least 1 year, but she ended up staying for 10. And Charles was a pretty important person in the government, and he was also friends with all of the big name people of the period, like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Daniel Webster of Daniel Webster Dictionary. That's like, he made the dictionary. And even Charles Dickens. I wrote Charles Dickinson because I'm stupid, but I mean Charles Dickens. And Adeline Landman, his wife, had been educated at the Convent of Visitations, which was an elite women's high school. So they're a pretty smart, well, really well-to-do family. When Ume was about to move back in with the Landmans, she wrote a letter addressed to, quote, "My dear American mother." And she wrote this in English, and she barely knew English, so it's a very sweet letter, so I'll read it. "You are a very nice woman. You are kind to me. You love me. Yesterday, we will go to the woods, and we have a very nice time. You are kind, and I never forget. I am very glad this winter stay at your house." And she signed the letter, "Your affectionate Japan daughter."
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, it's so cute. And so, for the first time, the three younger girls who called themselves the trio were separated. Sudamatsu suddenly became a youngest sister, living with the older girl with older girls Nellie and Alice, who were 16 and 14. And she was doted on by the rest of her family, who called her Stemets instead of Sudamatsu. And that became like her name. Even the other Japanese girls would call her Stemets. She spent her morning studying with Mrs. Bacon and then would practice piano with Nellie. And she and the youngest daughter Alice quickly bonded. And keep the name Alice in mind because she's here for the long haul.
I feel like Alice is the only name I'm going to remember in this thing anyway.
Oh my gosh, Marva. And that vastly improved her English skills because now she had like a best friend and sister who spoke English. And eventually she started attending a girls' primary school with Alice. She also started volunteering at Our Society, which was an elite women's group to sew clothes and make diapers for struggling Black families and refugees. And this was all super new for Sudamatsu because public education and private philanthropy were both not things in Japan yet. And Sudamatsu made friends at school and still stayed in touch with Shige, who lived just a 30-minute walk away. And both girls also stayed in touch with young Ume and went to visit her for Christmas in 1874. And Sudamatsu's host family, even though they loved her a lot, they were not super well off, but the Landmans were living a super lush lifestyle and spoiled the girls whenever they came to visit. And Ume seemed to be doing well because Sudamatsu wrote to her host mother, "Ume is as talkative as ever. She can read and recite poetry very well, and it is true that she received 4 prizes. Do you not remember that we read about in the newspaper in Colebrook?" So she was like making news, which is pretty impressive for like a little 7-year-old, or at this point, like a 9-year-old. And as she thrived more and more in Georgetown, Ume started forgetting about her life before the Landmans because she had left Japan when she was just 6 years old.
Oh no.
Yeah. And her family really treated her like a daughter. And when she wrote to her biological mother, now she wrote in English.
Did her biological mother read English?
No, but her husband, like her dad, does kind of.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sure like someone could translate it for her. And Ume's foster father was a prolific writer. He published around 30 books, which is crazy. And he taught his young foster daughter the skill of composition. Her first book was a tiny book that was 4 by 2 inches and bound by string. And it was called The Little Book of Ume from Japan to America.
Oh, that is so cute.
I know. And it's a 250-word essay about her journey across the Pacific and the American continent. I know. So adorable and so small. Yeah. So she was obviously pretty remarkable academically already because she learned English like that and was writing little baby books. Mm-hmm. So she started attending school at Georgetown Collegiate Institute, which was just a few blocks away, and her teachers called her attentive and studious. Where Sudamatsu's brother forbade her from becoming Christian, Ume asked to be baptized a year after her arrival in the U.S., and that was right when Japan had lifted its ban on Christianity in February 1873. Ume was so fond of Christianity that she would sometimes visit Jeffrey and Margaret Savelle, who were an elderly Black couple that worked for her foster family, on Sunday mornings and conduct a mini Sunday school.
Which, she would be the Sunday school.
Which is like cute, I think. Like,
she's like, "I'm a Christian for 5 minutes. Let me tell you how."
Literally. So a month after her baptism, Ume found out that her younger brother had died at 2 years old. Yeah, back in Japan.
Did she even know him?
So I think he was alive when she left, but like a baby. So she wrote a comforting letter to her mother, assuring her that he was in heaven. And interestingly, Ume's parents had also both discovered Christianity recently and started going to church in Japan as soon as the ban on Christianity was lifted, which I think goes along with her father's like obsession with like Western stuff, so he was like more exposed to that. Between 1873 and 1875, Ume won several awards and was mentioned in the newspaper multiple times for academic achievements. Meanwhile, Sudamatsu was having 2 simultaneous educations. Her brother was careful to make sure she maintained proficiency in Japanese and also maintained ties to her culture through weekly lessons in Japanese language and Confucian philosophy. When Kenjiro, her brother, graduated from Yale and returned to Japan in 1875, he continued tutoring his sister remotely by sending her long letters on Japanese politics. Which is like, yes, that's what every teenage girl wants, is long letters about politics.
I just still can't get over it. Like, I understand, like, yeah, he doesn't want her to lose their culture and stuff, but, like, it's just so strange to send them away for such a long time.
Like, I mean, it wasn't his choice. It was his older brother's choice.
Yeah, but, I mean, to send your, like, she was, like, 11 or something at the time, like, to send her away and be like, okay, we'll see you in 10 years.
I know. It's such a long time, especially because they're so young. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, so in July of 1876, Sudamatsu, Shige, and Ume were reunited again in Philadelphia for a centennial celebration of the United States. And I talked about this a little bit on our Instagram because at this centennial like fair or whatever, there were like a lot of Japanese people who were wearing like traditional clothes and they're being like bullied, and then they eventually like changed to Western clothes. So if you guys want to read about that, it's on our Instagram.
I don't want to read about people being bullied.
Marva, it's an important part of American history. American history is just white people bullying everyone else.
It's too sad. I can't take it.
Okay. So at the celebration, they took a picture together, which I'll also post on our Instagram because it's super cute. And then the following spring in 1877, Sudamatsu graduated from high school. To celebrate, Sudamatsu and Shige organized a trip to the beach in Southampton, but Sudamatsu's oldest foster sister, Rebecca, was like outraged by this. She wrote to Mrs. Bacon telling her that Sudamatsu was acting far too grown up now that she graduated. She said that...
Now that she's an adult.
Yeah. I mean, graduated high school, though. She's still young, but yeah. In the 1870s, that is like grown up.
Yeah, I mean, even now, like, people graduate when they're, like, 17 or 18. So, like, technically, she is a grown-up.
Yeah, that's true. But, yeah, she said, now it is plain that Stemmitz is getting too big for her breeches and ought to be made to see that because she is an inexperienced child, she does wrong to herself not to consult those who have her in her charge. Because I guess she just went ahead and tried to plan this without, like, asking for permission. But
I don't know. Rebecca just seems jealous.
Yeah. She's, yeah, definitely... overly strict, but she's also like, she's not like an older sister who's like 20, she's like 50. She's like a more maternal figure. Mm-hmm. And so, forbidden to go on her own, Sudamatsu went with the landmans in Ume instead, and the Japanese embassy covered the cost of her trip, which is super nice. Mm-hmm. Then in 1878, Ume started high school at the Archer Institute. And it was a girls' school that was about an hour away. So instead of walk to school, she traveled to school in a horse-drawn tram, which I just didn't know was a thing. But it's, like, mm-hmm. a bus, but, like, with horses, I just didn't know that existed.
Like a stagecoach.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. But even just for, like, an hour, I didn't know, like, yeah. So at school, she excelled in Latin, math, physics, astronomy, French, and piano. So basically every subject. And the same year that Ume graduated high school, Sudamatsu and Shige started college at Vassar, a women's college in New York that had been founded just 17 years earlier as one of the first women's colleges in America. And they were the first non-white students to attend the college, and they lived in the same dorm with the entire school. Sudamatsu, unlike her foster sister Alice, was able to go to college because the Bacon family couldn't afford to send their own daughter to college, but the Japanese government paid for Sudamatsu and Shige to go. Mm-hmm. And board and tuition amounted to $400 per year, which was half the stipend allotted to the girls, which is a lot, but also, like, they still have $400 more to just have fun, so I'm like, that's pretty nice.
Like, what is $400 in today's money?
I can look it up. The fact that I have, like, inflation calculator Bank of England saved on my... So, $800 in 1871 is about $17,000 today.
That's not that much, though. Because then if they used half of that for their school...
Yeah, but room and board. Like, their food, their lodgings, their tuition.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like, I wasn't making $9,000 in college, I feel like. I don't know, honestly, but I don't think
I'm sure that you made $9,000 a year.
Okay, yeah, that's true. I don't know. Well, I spent all. Whatever. Anyways, so while they were at school, Sudamatsu made it a rule for her and Shige to meet every day for at least an hour to talk in Japanese. And while Sudamatsu had grown up in America, her biological sister Misao had moved to Russia. But Misao and their brother Kenjiro would write letters to Sudamatsu when she was in college. But Misao did not read or write in Japanese or English, so she would write to her sister in French. And then Sudamatsu would get a group of girls together at Vassar to help her translate and reply in French. And I just think that's really sweet, like sisterhood, enabling sisterhood. Like she asked her friends to help her write to her sister. And then Sudamatsu excelled academically as well as socially, and she was elected president of her class after her first year. Then during summer vacations, Sudamatsu and Shige would often travel with the landmans in Ume because the landmans were super wealthy and well-connected, so they would spend time with the intellectual elite at beachside resorts in New England. In 1881, each girl received word that their 10 years were almost up. But Ume and Sudamatsu applied for extensions so they could finish high school and college, respectively. And Shige was doing a special music program at Vassar, which was only 3 years, so she didn't have a reason to stay. Plus, I don't know, like, what's wrong with the American countryside, but she was also starting to go, like, not go blind, but have, like, eye problems. Mm-hmm. And she was worried about it, I guess, so she wanted to go back to Japan.
How strange.
I know, yeah, but two of them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Ume went up to Vassar in 1881 for Shige's commencement ceremony. Then after Shige left, Sudamatsu missed her close friend and roommate dearly. She wrote to Ume, "I think of Shige very often and wonder what she is doing far away. I'd give anything to know how she felt as she landed and met her friends." Over Christmas break in 1881, Sudamatsu faced another loss. Leonard Bacon, her foster dad, passed away on Christmas Eve at the age of 79. She was by his bedside when he died. And when she returned to Vassar, her foster mom, Catherine, sent Sudamatsu a photo of Leonard as a keepsake, and she kept it on her desk while she was at school.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah. She wrote to her foster mom saying, "I'm sure it'll be a great help to me to have the picture. When I look at it, I cannot but wish to be good and true as he would have wished me to be." I'm just like, that's so cute, so sweet. I know. So then 6 months later in June, Sudamatsu graduated from college, and the Japanese consul in New York and members of its staff gave Sudamatsu gifts for her graduation and attended the commencement ceremony, at which Sudamatsu gave a speech. And her speech, unlike a lot of the other girls' speeches, which are like really academic, hers was more political, and it was about British policy towards Japan and the unfair trade agreements between the countries. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, girl, preach it.
But she's going to say that to, like, her students graduating from college, like...
Yeah, but there's, like, newspaper reporters there and stuff. So, yeah, multiple newspapers ended up writing about her speech and said it was the best one of the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And news of her achievement even reached Japan, where a newspaper said, "Miss Yamakawa brought great honor not only to herself, but to her country." Mm-hmm. So, good on her. Mm-hmm. And all of the girls do feel like, even after 10 years, a super strong duty and, like, tie to Japan.
Yeah, well, I'm like, I live outside of my country, and the American Embassy has done absolutely nothing for me, sent me no gifts, sent me no money.
Yeah. True. And then, very sadly, a month after her graduation, her foster mom, Catherine, who had been sick pretty much ever since she moved in with her, passed away and was buried next to her husband. Then on their journey back, Sudamatsu and Ume were accompanied part of the way by Alice Bacon, her foster sister, and the landmans.
On their journey back where?
To, like, across the country to go back to Japan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they left right after they graduated, basically. And then in Chicago, the landmans said goodbye and passed the girls into the guardianship of the Reverend J.D. Davis and his wife. Then in the Midwest, the girls were once again exoticized and treated like spectacles more than people. And Sudamatsu seemed pretty outraged by this and exhausted by all the people who were gawking at them and trying to interview them. But Ume just found it mostly funny. Mm-hmm. And yeah, she was also kind of problematic and racist at this point. So
who was?
Ume. Yeah.
Racist to who?
To Chinese people, to Black people, to Native American people, like everyone who's not white or Japanese.
Uh-huh. It's interesting because, you know, was it in Japan? I think it was Japan where, like, dad would go, like, with the Navy and people would, like, be like, oh, take pictures of him and, like, that kind of stuff.
That wasn't Japan. That was Korea and Thailand. Uh-huh. Yeah. So they finally set sail on Halloween on October 31st, 1882. And this time they traveled in much better style with the first class passengers, most of which were Christian missionaries who were headed to Japan. And they slept in a shared stateroom and lay awake most nights, talking late into the evening. The night before they arrived, Ume wrote that, "I am wild with joy and can hardly contain myself. Next moment, I am filled with strange misgivings. If only I could speak my own language, it would be so much easier for me."
She doesn't speak Japanese
No, she
anymore.
doesn't speak Japanese at all anymore. Like, she's been writing to her family in English. She was separated from Sudamatsu and Shige, so like no one she knew spoke Japanese. And Sudamatsu can speak Japanese, but her reading and writing is like really bad. So when they finally saw land on November 20th, Sudamatsu said she felt like she could scream, but whether that's for joy or fear, I'm not totally sure. She definitely had a stronger connection to Japan than Ume. But like I said, she'd already forgotten to read and write Japanese, so that was difficult, and she'd spent most of her critical years in America. Once back in Japan, Ume wrote letters to her American mother constantly, literally constantly for decades. Like, we have so much information about her life. And she even called her mother her journal because she told her literally everything. And she would sometimes write even 20-page long letters, and she tried to have something to send every time a mail boat went out. There was like one period in her life when she was like helping a friend with like a personal crisis that she like stopped writing to her mom, and that was like the only time.
I mean, that would be so hard.
Yeah, for sure. And both girls' families, like their biological families, tried to ease them back into Japan. Ume's parents would serve bread and other foreign foods at every meal, and Sudamatsu's family would order foreign food from a nearby restaurant for her. And Ume's older sister tried to reteach her Japanese. But she was still lonely and deeply missed Mrs. Landman. She enjoyed visiting Shige, whose house became kind of like a salon for repatriated Japanese people. But she would just visit her when she could, and she wasn't able to go there super, super often. And at home, her father was very strict, unlike the indulgent parents she had in America. And when I say indulgent, they literally shipped a piano back with her. Like,
Oh,
they
dang.
like want her to have everything. They always spoiled her. Like, yeah. And plus, her family and their like the visitors they had at their house would treat Ume the way Americans had when she first arrived, like an exotic doll. They all wanted to see her American dresses and hats, and she felt like she was putting on a show for them. But still, she preferred wearing Western clothing for now because that's what she was most used to. And at one point, she even said she thought it would be better if she'd never gone to America at all, just because it was like such a hard transition back. And Ume hoped to find fulfillment through work because all of the male students who had studied abroad had been offered government jobs when they returned to Japan, but no such offer was made to Sudamatsu or Ume. And that didn't mean they weren't busy. Ume spent her time helping her father write business letters, caring for her seven younger siblings. Her mom was literally always pregnant, going to church and playing piano for her Bible study students. And as she spent more time in Japan, especially among Japanese women, she observed how little social mobility and opportunities they had. And she became increasingly passionate about this cause. She also noticed that the Christian missionaries in Japan really kept to themselves and kind of looked down on Japanese people. Yeah, I know, not super nice. And so she thought that Japanese people could do a better job as missionaries to help their own people. And in Ume's biography, the author Yoshiko Furuki says Ume wanted to work not as an outsider, but as a daughter of Japan for her people and especially her sisters. Ever since her days in America, Ume had dreamed that she, Shige, and Sudamatsu would open a school together. But that dream started fading when Shige got married just weeks after Sudamatsu and Ume returned. Plus, Shige's music degree allowed her to get a well-paid job as a piano instructor through the Ministry of Education's Music Investigation Committee. And so she was just doing her own thing. And for Ume, marriage was not at all on her radar. And her father didn't really try to push the idea on her, so it wasn't like a pressing thing. And that wasn't the case for Sudamatsu. So Sudamatsu's family was actually like full of professionals. Even the women worked because like one of her sisters studied abroad. They're like all pretty educated. But her older brothers felt an obligation to the samurai from their home in Aizu. So they financially supported 20 different relatives and friends, and also took in students and boarders constantly. Mm-hmm. So they were like really strapped for money.
Yeah.
And so marriage would allow Sudamatsu to help her family and also be less of a burden financially. And she seemed to have some luck when she met a young man at Shige's house, who, like I said, had this like salon. And his name was Naibu Kanda. He was a graduate from Amherst College in America, and he was an English teacher at a university. And he got to know Sudamatsu through a private production of The Merchant of Venice that they put on. And Ume and Sudamatsu both performed in it at a party for Shige and her husband. And he had already indicated that he was interested in marrying her, and a bunch of other guys also wanted to marry her. Like, she's super pretty and, like, really smart. She's the only girl with, like, an actual college degree in Japan, like, in the whole country.
Oh, wow.
So she was in, like, high demand.
Yeah. Shige didn't have a college degree?
Hers was, like, a certificate, like, a music certificate. Sudamatsu put off giving him an answer and just, like, got to know him. But after spending a lot of time with him in the play, she decided that he was, quote, very young and boyish, and rejected him. Then she did a full 180 to someone old and mannish and got engaged to a man named Oyama Iwao, who was a general and was 18 years older than her, and had actually, this is crazy to me, he directed the attack on Aizu Castle, which is where Sudamatsu and her family had been besieged a long time ago, and she literally was like, hit by, like, shrapnel and stuff. Like, yeah, same guy. And
why did she?
Yeah, so at first her brothers were like, absolutely not. But then they were like, actually, this is good to, like, have, like, peace between our families. So they, like, actually ended up supporting it.
It's like, I don't know. There's peace, and then there's marrying the person who tried to kill you.
I know. It's so crazy. And did kill, like, thousands of people from your hometown. But whatever. Not really whatever, but she said whatever. And so she didn't really take the decision lightly, but she did agree to marry him because she, like Ume, kind of didn't want to get married at first. But then she thought that, like, her status as a married woman would allow her to make more positive changes for Japanese women because it was basically unheard of for an unmarried Japanese woman to make a difference in Japan.
Yeah.
So they were married on November 8th, 1883, just about a year after Sudamatsu and Ume returned to Japan. And it was a really small ceremony at his house. But the next day, close family and friends were allowed over for dinner. And already the dynamic between Sudamatsu and Ume had started to change because now Ume had to call her Oku-san, which means like madam. And Sudamatsu had to play the role of like a perfect hostess and wife rather than just chat privately with her friend. So she kind of became, like, grown up overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, a general is, like, he's, like, very high-ranking. Yeah. He's, like, very fancy. So, like, she's also now very fancy.
Mm-hmm.
So in the summer of 1883, Ume finally got her first job as an English teacher in a girls' school that her father had helped found a decade earlier. So her dad actually had helped found, like, a bunch of girls' schools. Like, he's, like, pretty passionate about it. And she taught a summer course and then was offered a position back there in the fall, but she declined because in her mind, teaching was like too small of a thing for her. But then a few months later, she met Utako Shiboda, who was another woman who had founded a private school for elite women and girls. And then Ume was like, elite? Okay. Like, and then
somebody's in my name.
Yeah. And so she started working there teaching English, and in exchange, Utako would help her learn Japanese. And at the same time, she became a live-in English teacher, which was kind of more like a governess slash ladies companion in the house of a government minister named Ito, like his household. And Ume could learn Japanese language and manners from a woman of his house, but she was able to wear Western clothes exclusively and eat Western meals. So that was like a nice like middle ground, I guess, for her. And the family was super wealthy, so she was back to living in luxury the way she had in America and not living with seven siblings and like, you know, all this stuff. So then in February 1884, Ito got Sudamatsu, Ume, and some other learned ladies together to discuss creating a school for well-born girls that was going to be funded by the Empress.
Because they thought a school for some normal girls.
I know. I know. They don't really care about normal girls. And also they thought if the Empress funds it, that'll be like a good symbol to people who are like, education matters. So that was like this why this new school is going to be founded. Mm-hmm. And the project came at a good time for Sudamatsu because her husband was gone to Prussia for a year to study like military strategy. And she stayed behind because she was pregnant. But so she was like alone. So she had some time. Mm-hmm. Not alone. She has three stepdaughters, but alone enough to focus on this. Mm-hmm. And she was super essential to this project because she was still the only woman in Japan with a college degree. And she had a considerable amount of power and influence after her marriage. And she also started another major undertaking during this time, which was organizing a massive fundraiser for a charity hospital in Tokyo. And like I said, like charity didn't really exist as a concept here. Mm-hmm. So she kind of like brought this over. So she, Ume, and a few other women managed to get over 200 women to make paintings and embroidery and like other art things to sell for the fundraiser. And so that was really cool. Then a few months after the fundraiser, Sudamatsu gave birth to her first daughter, Hisako. Then in September, a major milestone for the school happened when Ume was given an official government job as teacher and awarded a salary of 420 yen per year, which is not a lot at all. I don't know how yen translates to now, but nowadays 420 yen would be like $4.20. Like it's like very, very small. But it's also way cheaper to live in Japan than in America, like in this time period. So that was like actually like a good amount of money. But they did pay the Western teachers a lot more money, even if they had less experience, which is...
Western if they were like from America, but does this count for these girls?
No, like I'm saying like they would pay them more than Ume, like people who came from like England or America. And then a month later on October 5th, the school, which is called the Pyrrhus' School, officially opened. In addition to Japanese, they learned Chinese literature, English or French, and history. And they also studied morals, calligraphy, drawing, sewing, tea ceremony, flower arrangement, household management, and formal etiquette. And they stopped learning math once they reached their teenage years.
I wish I would have learned flower arrangement.
I know, right? But yeah, so as you can see, this school kind of became like also like a finishing school, especially as they got older.
Yeah.
In July of 1884, this act called the Act of I don't know what it's called, the Act of 1884. I feel like there's a name. Hold on.
In 1884, they made an act called the Act of 1884.
Yeah. Oh, the Nobility Act. Okay. So in July of 1884, the Nobility Act of 1884... made General Oyama become Count Oyama and made Sudamatsu Countess Sudamatsu.
Yeah, girl.
Yeah, so it basically like conferred titles on non-nobles who had been of unusual service to Japan. So he did something spectacular.
But is the thing that he did that was spectacular the attacking her?
I think so. Super awkward.
I mean, way to benefit, make tragedy into triumph.
Girl. Yeah, yeah. So then in 1886, Sudamatsu gave birth to a baby boy named Takashi, but after his birth, she started having a lot of problems with pregnancies. She had a miscarriage and then a premature baby who died when she was only two days old, which was really sad. And then with the Pyrrhus school up and running, Ume and Sudamatsu were already on to the next thing. And in March 1887, Sudamatsu and Ume got the idea to start an anti-geisha society, which I'm not in favor of this, but I understand where they're coming from. So geishas were like women who were trained to entertain men with conversation, dance, and song. And so a lot of like noblemen's wives would usually be former geishas because they're like the ideal wife because they're like trained in these skills. And so Sudamatsu was like really like unusual because she wasn't a former geisha. And like Ume like really didn't like the idea of geishas, I guess. She wanted just like women to be like educated and then like educated women to be the wives of these high ranking men.
Well, I mean, they're educated just in different things.
Exactly. So that was annoying in my opinion. And Ume wrote to her foster mom, "Although, as a rule, I detest societies of any kind, I've been led to becoming a mover in this one." But around the same time, Sudamatsu started being attacked in the media, probably because she was so different from the other women mm-hmm. of her rank, and she didn't really try to mingle with them. She was like, they're annoying, I don't like them. And so maybe because of all this drama, or just because it was a dumb idea and everyone was like, that's sexist, the anti-gayster society never really amounted to anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like just being like, I don't like women who are different from me, yeah. so I'm going to start a club about it.
I know, and I'm like, what are you going to do, sit around and be like, we hate Asians?
Yeah, I really don't like you.
Yeah. And who's going to come? Because all the women in your rank were former Asians. Yeah. So then in the summer of 1887, Ume moved out of Ito's house to live with a female cousin, which was a mark of independence. And this cousin was like a widow, so I guess it was probably more acceptable. But Ume, having like never married, just being like, oh, I'm just going to live with my cousin, was like really independent. Then in the fall of that year, Ume hired Sudamatsu's foster sister, Alice Bacon, to be a second English teacher at the school. So she moved to Japan for the job.
Wow.
Yeah. And she arrived in June 1888 and moved into a house with Ume and a few of Ume's female relatives, so like her cousin and some nieces.
Was there more than five of them?
I don't think so.
Because, I mean, you talk about your anti-geisha society, you got five women living in a house, it's a brothel.
I know. Yeah. According to Massachusetts law. But yeah, so while they lived together, Alice was a great companion to Ume, and she even encouraged her to move back to America to go to college. And she visited Sudamatsu practically every day because she had been in low spirits after losing her two babies. Mm-hmm. Then Alice left in July of 1889, but she at least had a chance to meet Sudamatsu's second son, a baby boy who was born in June 1889. And I guess being surrounded by kids gave Alice baby fever because she ended up adopting Ume's cousin's niece, who was just 5 years old, and moved back to America with her when she left. So she came for a job and left with a child. Then, so Ume was not far behind, not in the baby thing, but in the America thing. Because the following year, she made that long trek across the Pacific again to start college. It's only 3 weeks.
No,
at this point,
I could not spend 3 weeks
on a boat. I know, it's a lot. Yeah, and then 100-something hours on trains across the country. Yeah,
whew. It's not for me.
But yeah, so she started college in September 1889 at Bryn Mawr, and her school agreed to give her the school she taught at gave her 2 years of paid leave in order to support her while she completed her education. And the college gave her a scholarship to reduce tuition, room, and board. She majored in biology and went really all in. She spent her first school break doing field study with her professors. She also assisted professors in writing published papers and books. And one of her friends wrote that Ume was, quote, given de facto graduate standing on maturity and brains. So she was just treated like really special. And then she spent the summer of 1890 living with Alice and helping her write her book, Japanese Girls and Women. And the book was dedicated to Sudamatsu, and the preface was written by Ume. So it's kind of like a collaborative thing.
Mm-hmm.
And while she was in America, she also needed to prioritize learning about teaching strategies so that she could bring those skills back to Japan. And in January 1891, she went to New York to study methods of teaching for 6 months. Instead of returning to Japan in September 1891, like she originally planned, she had planned for an extension of her paid leave and was able to stay an extra year to study women's education. During her last 2 years in America, Ume started raising funds for a scholarship, which would pay for a Japanese girl to move to and study in America every 3 or 4 years, and like fully funded.
Mm-hmm.
So she gave multiple speeches on women's education and was super successful in her fundraising efforts. By the time she left, she'd raised almost $8,000, which was what she said she needed to get started. Mm-hmm. And then they could use the interest every year to like fund future students. And her scholarship ultimately supported 11 students between 1893 and 1941.
Wow.
Yeah, really cool. She created this thing that just, like, lasted forever. Yeah.
Not forever, but...
Okay, for, like, outlived her. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah, I guess it kind of ended in World War II time.
Probably, yeah. I mean, World War II changed a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
So, Oh, yeah, because Japan.
Yeah.
Awkward.
you're like, yeah, maybe. I mean, who really knows?
Yeah. So Ume finally moved back to Japan in August 1892 and started teaching again right away. But after working so much in women's education, she once again came to Japan with big plans. Her friend from Bern Mar, Anna Hartshorn, moved to Japan the following year, and Ume started talking to her about starting her own school. And Anna said that her plan seemed already like really well thought out, but Ume was really busy and the plan didn't take shape right away. In 1898, though, she got a job at the Teachers College for Women, and in the same year, she traveled to America again for an international convention of the General Federation of Women's Clubs. After that, she was invited to visit England by several prominent British women and sailed there on November 12, 1898. While she was there for 5 months, she attended some classes and inspected several universities and colleges to see how they were run. She also attended Oxford as a special student for 2 months. Unlike Bryn Mawr or any of the other schools she'd attended, Oxford was primarily a male university, but women attended it too and just kept mostly to themselves. So that was like a unique experience for her. And she left England in April 1899 and sailed to New York, where she saw Mrs. Landman and went to their old vacation spot before traveling across the country and sailing back to Japan. As Ume traveled back and forth between East and West, Tsutomatsu was tasked with bringing the West to the East. She was appointed advisor on Westernization and court, which involved frequent visits to court, advising the Empress and her ladies on Western fashion and manners, and being an interpreter for the wives of foreign dignitaries. Around 1890, the Oyamas moved into a grand Western-style house where their children dressed in Western clothing. They did also have a Japanese section of the house, though, where the children spent a lot of their time, so they didn't feel totally disconnected from their culture. Her husband also had increasing responsibilities because in August 1894, Japan declared war on China, and he was the head of Japan's Second Army. Tsutomatsu wrote to Alice that she felt very anxious about all of it, but was certain that Japan would be victorious and that her husband would return safely. She did her part to assist the war effort by fundraising for the military and volunteering with the Ladies Nursing Association. After Japan won the war in just 8 short months, Tsutomatsu's husband got promoted from count to marquis and became the subject of international newspapers.
What's the name of a marquis's wife?
A marchioness.
Okay.
I think, or marchioness? No, march. What's the C-H?
A marchioness.
Marchioness.
Maybe? I don't know. It sounds dumb.
It's like M-A-R-C-H-I-O-N-N-E-S or something. Yes. Uh-huh. M-M-I-R. march, whatever. That's what she is.
I just don't like that name.
Yeah, it's not super cute. American journalists credited his success with his wife's enlightened American education, just because they wanted to take credit for Japan's accomplishments.
But, like, okay, at least for one time, like,
a woman gets credit. I know, yeah. That's true. That's a good point. But as we've seen in the past with Tsutomatsu, not all of her publicity was good publicity. So in 1895, Tsutomatsu's oldest stepdaughter from her husband's first marriage had a dramatic divorce, and someone wrote a novel based on their family drama because they are like a really famous family, prominent family. And the book, which was first published serially, like in magazines or whatever, in 1898 and 1899, and then published as a novel in 1900, was pretty sympathetic to most of the family members, but was extremely critical of Tsutomatsu's character and made her out to be, like, way too influenced by Western culture and trying to force that on her family.
She's, like, the evil stepmother.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's also, like, that's just, like, a valid... Okay, so basically, there's a whole lot of stuff I haven't talked about. But basically, like, the short story is Japan loves the West in, like, 1870s. And then while they're in America, Japan was like, whoa, this is a bit much. Uh-huh. And, like, now there's, like, a, like, more nationalist kind of vibe. And so her bringing, like, the Western vibes here, which she was. Like, she moved into a Western house, made her kids wear Western clothes.
Yeah.
At the school they ran, the kids had to wear Western clothes. Like, it was, like, a lot. And, like, now that was just, like, not – that was, like, out of fashion.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it does make sense, but it's not nice. And the same year the book was published, Ume finally resigned from both of her teaching jobs in July 1900 to start her own women's college. There were obviously already a lot of girls' schools in Japan at this point, many of which were started by her father. There's obviously the Pyrrhus School, which she and Tsunematsu had helped found. And in 1899, the government even passed a law that every prefecture, which is like a state, had to have at least one girls' school. But Ume's college was one of only two institutions for higher learning for women in Japan. And it was more radical because the goal was not to raise girls to be good wives and mothers through instilling Confucian values in young girls, but rather, as Ume's biographer put it, Ume took it to be her mission to initiate the work of preparing Japanese women for new and demanding roles.
But is this not the school where they were teaching the flower arranging and the tea service?
That's the Pyrrhus School that she already worked at. That's the one she just quit. So she's opening a college now, for higher learning.
Not that flower arranging is not a good job.
No, like that's, yeah, but that's the thing. Is like those things were like teaching girls to be, like she's still like, in our perspective, she's still very traditional, but she's like more progressive because she wants to teach girls like liberal arts and like have like a education beyond like womanly things or whatever. Mm-hmm. So a few months before Ume had quit, Alice Bacon and her adopted daughter, Ume's young cousin, had moved back to Japan to assist with founding the college. Together, they opened the Women's Home School of English in September 1900, with Marchioness Tsunematsu as their patron and official advisor. The first year welcomed 14 girls who would live and attend school there for 3 years. In the first 6 months, the school's attendance doubled, but they only let in the best and the brightest. By January of the school's second year, they had 60 students. Unfortunately, during this year, Alice had to go back to America after she received news about her brother passing away. And also during this year, Ume made a big step of establishing her own household separate from her father's family. So she still had her same last name, but she was just registered like as her own person. And this was like really uncommon, but she wanted to make a name for herself in her own right. And she also changed her first name from Ume to Umeko because it sounded more modern. And she did keep her rank as samurai, though. So she still identified herself within the traditional Japanese class structure.
I feel like she's definitely like picks and chooses like what works for her. She's like, I'll still be a samurai because like that's like a good class to be part of. Mm-hmm.
And in March 1902, Shige, Tsunematsu, and Ume attended a 30-year reunion for the Iwakura mission. So now they're all a lot older. They're in their 30s and 40s. And they were the only women there. Ryo had passed away long ago, and no one had seen Tei since she left America, like, back in the first year. And they spent the following month together with Alice as much as possible before her departure. Ume's college continued to grow rapidly. By 1903, they had already outgrown several houses and moved into a more official building, thanks to funding by a Japanese women's society, which Shige and Tsunematsu were both a part of, and a surprise gift of $6,000 from an American benefactress. The following year, the school gained the status of vocational college, which was the highest standard of a woman's private school could attain. Ume's nieces and Tsunematsu's daughter all attended, and in 1904 to 1905, her school's success of getting 150 new students was happening in the shadow of yet another war, this time the war you mentioned, the Russo-Japanese War.
Oh, yeah.
So Tsunematsu's husband once again played a critical role.
He must be extremely old.
I know. Like. Yeah, it's wild. But after the war ended in a stalemate, he was promoted to prince, and Tsunematsu became Princess Tsunematsu.
Wow, I didn't know you could get promoted to prince.
I know. Me either. But I think it's that act, the nobility act, makes it like you get titles with your successes. So Tsunematsu's oldest son ended up following in his father's footsteps and joined the military. Shige's oldest son also joined the military, and they were assigned to the same mission in 1908. Tragically, an accidental explosion sunk their ship, and both sons died.
Oh, no.
I know. So sad. They were on the same mission, and it's like their best friend's kid, like, age. Yeah.
At least they have each other to, like, comfort each other and be like, I actually do totally understand what you're going through.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, Shige said at least, like, Tsunematsu was, like, trying to be so strong for Shige, but then, like, Shige was, like, trying to be there for Tsunematsu, and it's, like, it's hard because you did both go through the exact same thing, but, yeah. you know.
But then, like, maybe you know what each other needs.
And yeah.
Like, you have a bad day today, and I'll be strong. And then you have a bad day tomorrow. And
yeah, maybe.
We all also be strong.
I don't think that's how grief works, unfortunately. You can't schedule it, but.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. A few years later, in 1913, Ume took a trip to the U.S. to promote her school and saw her foster mother, which she didn't know, but this was for the last time. Adeline, who she had written to constantly for the past several decades, was nearly 90, already widowed, and not in good health. And while she was there, Ume helped, because her house was kind of falling apart, she helped, like, get the house, like, back together and stuff. But she ended up passing away shortly after Ume's visit. Then in 1916, Sudamatsu's husband, who, as you predicted, was very old, passed away. And even amidst all this loss, the school these women had made possible continued to thrive, although not in the way they expected. Ume, who had once seemed more progressive among proponents of female education, was frustrated by what she called a new generation of selfish women who promoted women's rights in a loud, but distinctly not Japanese way. Like she said, like, that's...
Ume is too much. Like, she can't even make up her mind.
She can't have
it
both
ways.
Now
she's like, oh, this is, like, not Japanese. And it's like, you were the one before who didn't want to be Japanese. And, like, also, like, oh, we don't like geishas. And now we don't like women's rights. Like, what are you talking
She never about? Not wanted to be Japanese. She always felt, like, a strong sense of duty and,
but
like,
But she was the one
loyalty.
Who, like, didn't want to wear Japanese clothes and, like, stuff.
Yeah, but that's not being Japanese.
Yeah,
like, she
I
always...
Mean,
felt
like as far as Japanese traditions, like she's saying, like, oh, she doesn't like this thing because it's not like Japanese tradition.
Yeah, I think she like exempts herself from a lot of things because she never wanted to get married and never tried to get married. But she still does think, like, ultimately, like, the benefit of women's education is to make like the American style wives, like people like her foster mom who were educated and could be like a real companion and like intellectual equal to her partner. And, like, be in, like, a public sphere in a way that, like, Japanese women, like, traditionally were not. But she still thinks they should be good wives, wise mothers. Like, that kind of, like, mentality.
Yeah, but I think it's fine if you think that. But then it's just, like, I feel like she also does the thing of, like, putting down other people. Like, I feel like it's fine if you're like, oh, like, I think, like, this is a better way to do things. But then to be like, and I don't like you because you're a geisha.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start a society.
I know.
Like, it's all just
Yeah, no, she is very intense. Like, everything about her is intense, for sure.
A bit hypocritical, though, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. But yeah, it does turn out that Sudamatsu agreed with her, and she thought that, like, girls nowadays just weren't how they used to be. That was her complaint. And in 19...
But they're not how they used to be, but partly because you start all these schools and all this kind of stuff
That's
to
a good
make
point.
Them be not
yeah.
how they used to be.
Yeah, and they see you guys running around with your, like, schools and your charities and your college
Becoming
degrees.
Becoming a princess, like,
yeah. In 1917, Ume, who is now in her 50s, was hospitalized due to complications of diabetes. She was fine after that, but her health was definitely on the decline.
That is definitely that Western food, though.
Yeah, good point. And after her and Sudamatsu's close friend Alice passed away in 1918, and the First World War having just and having been going on,
existing,
yeah,
doing its thing,
and a global influenza pandemic on the horizon, death seemed to be all around. Maybe stress about her own health is what led Ume to resign from her college in 1919. One of the last events that Sudamatsu saw was the ceremony appointing Ume's college's next president. The next day, she woke up with a sore throat, and within 2 weeks, she had passed away from the flu.
Huh?
I know. I feel like every time I talk about my people dying, you're always shocked. I tried to lead up to it. I was like, this was her last event. She had a sore throat. I'm like, you know.
Okay, I have a sore throat most of the days I wake up in the morning. But I don't die from it.
Yeah.
But you didn't say that she had the flu anyways.
Well, that the sore throat was the sign of the flu.
Okay.
And there's
if
a global
said, like,
influenza pandemic.
Spanish influenza because of a pandemic. And then, you know, whatever.
Well, it was clearly foreshadowed. So, a week after Sudamatsu's death, Ume suffered a small stroke. And then a larger one 6 months later. Although she survived, she was partially paralyzed and lived out the rest of her life housebound and often isolated. One of her only friends left was Anna Hartshorne, who was her friend from college. But in 1923, a major earthquake destroyed the college, so Anna immediately went to America to raise funds to rebuild the college. She was gone for over 2 years, and Ume missed her greatly. Anna eventually returned and remained a constant companion with Ume. And one of the biographies I was reading was saying that Ume became kind of like, she had always been like possessive of Anna, and now she became like obsessive and would like just wanted to see her like all the time and like write a lot in her journals about like every single time she saw Anna. She was like very, I mean, she's completely alone, so it makes sense, but it just became a really intense relationship.
I mean, that screams Ume to me.
That's true, yeah.
There's nothing that she's done that has not been intense.
Yeah, Ume's like, I like you, move to Japan. Like, to everyone she knows.
Writing her foster mom 20-page letters.
Yeah, yeah. It's very intense. But, you know, that got her places, you know? So then, at the age of 64, Ume passed away in August 1929. After her death, her college was renamed Tsuda Aigaku Juku, which means the Tsuda Home School of English. Tsuda College exists today and has an enrollment of 3,249 women, according to Google. And there's a grove of plum trees there in her honor, because her name, Ume, means plum. Oh, yeah. And her mom named her because of a plum tree. Cute. Yeah, it's very cute. And starting in 2024, Tsuda Umeko's face will appear on the 5,000 yen banknotes in Japan.
Wow.
Yeah, super cool. And although Japanese people nowadays have kind of mixed feelings about her because she was like super, super Western and like, I don't know, there's just like some issues there.
Wait, I feel like the thing about her that you should not be on board with is not the Westernness. It's the like being a bit crazy, starting societies against people. Like,
Yeah, so I agree. But I spoke to TK from For the Love of History podcast, who specializes in Japanese history. Mm-hmm. And I was asking her about these women. And she said that Umeko has pretty mixed reviews in Japan because there's a split between loving her and hating her because she was too Western for the Meiji era. And her conversion to Christianity was really looked down upon. Mm-hmm. So those are like the main problems. Because, yeah, it was, like, during the time of, like, increased nationalism, and obviously that nationalism grew to, like, an extreme extent and resulted in a lot of bad stuff in World War II, but I do still think, like, Japan has, like, a lot of pride in being Japanese, yeah. And so, like, having someone come and be like, I'm going to make you better by making you Western is, like, problematic.
Yeah. No, I think that's not ideal for sure.
Yeah. And then, like, another point of controversy, which we talked about a little bit with her, is that she only taught women of a certain class. And, like, when she was offered a job at, like, with normal school, she's like, this is too small. And then it's, like, a fancy school. She's like, I'd love to. Mm-hmm. Like, so,
yeah.
Yeah, but she is, like, still a very well-known figure in Japan, and people learn, like, students learned about her in high school, like, in social studies classes. Tsudamatsu, on the other hand, even though she supported Ume every step of the way and was there for, like, kind of, like, social clout and, like, financial support, she chose the road more frequently traveled by marrying well and raising a family. And so her roles were often more behind the scenes, and she was already under constant fire for being too Western without even doing as much as what Ume was doing, which was way more intense and, like...
Yeah.
So... Her name ended up fading a bit with history, but I think their story definitely makes history.
Sistery.
Yeah. So that is the story of Tsuda Ume and Yamakawa Tsudamatsu. What? I was like...
did a little like
I did bow. Not do a bow. I put my hands together like, yay, we're done. Like, clap. Like,
as if, like,
oh my gosh, Marva, people are going to think I'm culturally appropriating. I'm not bowing. I'm just going like namaste. This. Oh my gosh. Namaste is not even a Japanese thing, Marva.
Oh my gosh.
Ah! Okay.
The shouting. That was really good. Yeah, something so strange. Like, never have heard anything... even like it, like that it existed.
I know, yeah. I was like so shocked when I found out about this, because originally I did want to do some sisters from Japan, but I wanted to do like a little bit earlier these two women who, like, one of them was like one of the first like female poets in Japan, but then I just, like, I don't know, fell down some rabbit hole and found out about this mission and found out that there were like five girls a part of it, and they did actually reunite with Tay, like, randomly, like decades later, like, after
the one who disappeared,
after the 30-year reunion. I feel like I'm, like, you know, like, at the end of, like, one of those, like, mystery shows when they like find out what happened. Oh, yeah. Like, uh-huh. I'm like, Tay appeared, blah, blah, blah. Like, and she had come back to Japan and married a doctor and just had like a really quiet, normal life. And she mm-hmm. was like embarrassed that she didn't do as much as the rest of them and wasn't like a career woman. So she just kept to herself. But then mm-hmm. she came over for tea one day and like the newspapers covered it. They were all like, wow, like she's emerged.
The missing Tay.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's such a fascinating story. It's like the definition of sistery because they were all, their lives were like super intertwined. Mm-hmm. I'll try to do some posts about Shige because she was kind of in the background of this. Mm-hmm. She got married right away and she did have like a more like normal life, but she like kind of like Tsutomatsu was like intertwined in this. Mm-hmm. She just didn't have like the status Tsutomatsu had of being like a princess. Yeah. And being like besties with the, no, she wasn't besties with the empress, but like hung out with her all the time and mm-hmm. stuff. So
yeah.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you guys enjoy this episode.
I enjoyed it, so
yeah, I'm glad.
Well, thanks for listening. We will speak at you next week.
Sistery! Wow! Thank you for listening to this episode of Sistery Untold. If you'd like to connect with us further, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Sistery Untold, or go to our website, sisteryuntold.com. On our website, you can find our blog, which has a little bit of information following up from each episode, as well as a list of all of our sources. So if you want to fact check us or just learn a little bit more about all of the cool things we're talking about, you can find that on our blog.
If you've enjoyed this episode, the best way to support us is by rating and reviewing Sistery Untold on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And tell your friends.